A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hello there, Herman and Corn. So we've talked about no shortage of obscure topics in this podcast. We've talked about some of the nuances of the most emerging agentic AI. We've talked about MQTT and IoT and low area networks and all these tech subjects that I find interesting. But now and again, you mentioned something in an episode and I feel, wow, we really haven't had a discussion about that, because what a pity to talk about the trending things in life without talking about the foundations upon which the world works. And I dedicate this episode to a dear friend of mine called Jason. We can refer to him affectionately as Uncle Jason. Jason is a really funny guy, and he has these curious interests that make him kind of the person that he is. One of them is sorbet. He's really into sorbet, and you can never bring sorbet that is unwelcome. So he comes with sorbet often, and he's also really into plants. So like, you'll see him kind of taking saplings, looking intensely at the plants in your house, and like taking some to like curate or something. So as you can kind of tell that I know very little about plants, but I do find it very endearing that he is so enthusiastic about plants. There's something very kind of compassionate about being a man of plants. And so I'd love to talk about indoor plants today. We mentioned their role in air quality, and we've also discussed on a lot of episodes outdoor air quality and how the air quality in Jerusalem in particular, and in Israel in fact, is surprisingly poor. Like, it kind of makes the news when there's a forest fire, but you look at the baseline and it's surprisingly bad. It's actually on average almost in India territory, and you look at the average AQI in London, etc., and it's substantially better. Part of the reason is topographical, geographical emissions and, you know, bad policy, and part of it is just simply geographic, especially for PM 2.5. There is just a lot of dust from the Sahara that swirls up to this part of the world. But Hannah, as you know, is an architect, as we often mention, and I think the plants have a role. You know, they're so crucial in our cities and our homes in many different ways. Part of it is just they make us feel better somehow. I don't understand that, but it's definitely true. We enjoy taking care of them, and they improve the air that we breathe. I'd love to know exactly a bit more about that quiet miracle, Herman and Corn, by which I mean we talked about air quality filters, and I feel like a home without any indoor plants would be a pretty sad space, but, you know, could it be fine? Do we need them for that purpose, or is it just that they kind of have some additional benefit? And let's talk about the role of plants in our cities. We talk about sort of green spaces and green belts. And again, I'm interested in understanding whether, to what extent that is about providing humans with a place that just isn't a depressing wall of concrete. Is there like a practical and pragmatic reason why we actually need it, or is it both? To be clear, I think we need as much green in cities as possible. I'd just like to understand exactly what the rationale is before, so I can more articulately advance the policy in our local green and environmental forum, with which I occasionally interact, and they're doing good work. I've been involved in the noise pollution side of it, but air pollution is a very near and dear to my heart topic as well. Herman and Corn, let's talk about the role of plants in making our living spaces and our cities more beautiful, more nice, more peaceful, and better to breathe in.
Daniel sent us this one for a friend of his, Uncle Jason, who apparently can't enter a room without inspecting the plants and bringing sorbet. Daniel wants to know whether indoor plants actually clean our air, or if that's just something we tell ourselves, and what role green spaces play in cities beyond making them less soul-crushing to look at. He's been involved in local environmental forums on the air and noise pollution side, and he wants the ammunition to advocate for green policy with actual facts, not just feelings.
Daniel, if you're listening, this one's for Jason. May his saplings thrive and his sorbet never melt.
Quick note, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today, so if I sound unusually articulate, that's why.
I was going to say you seem sharper than usual. Now I know it's not you at all.
Let's start with the thing everyone thinks they know. The NASA Clean Air Study from 1989. Herman, you've read the original paper.
And this is one of those cases where the popular understanding is almost completely wrong. The NASA study was real. Bill Wolverton and his team were looking at how to clean air in sealed space habitats. They put plants in small sealed chambers, injected volatile organic compounds, benzene, formaldehyde, trichloroethylene, and measured how concentrations dropped over 24 hours. The plants did reduce those VOCs. The finding was real. That's the key. A plant in a cubic meter sealed box is not a plant in your living room. The air exchange rate in a typical home, just through cracks, vents, opening doors, is about 0.5 to 1 air change per hour. That means the entire volume of air in your home is replaced every 1 to 2 hours. The plant can't keep up.
The plant is basically a teaspoon bailing out a rowboat with a hole in it.
Worse than a teaspoon. There was a review published in the Journal of Exposure Science and Environmental Epidemiology in 2019, Waring and Cummings from Drexel. They analyzed 12 studies, including the NASA work, and calculated what they called the clean air delivery rate. They found you'd need between 10 and 1,000 plants per square meter of floor space to match the VOC removal of just typical building ventilation. Let me say that again. 10 to 1,000 plants per square meter.
That's not a home. That's a greenhouse you happen to sleep in.
The low end, 10 plants per square meter, that's for the most optimistic plant, under ideal conditions, for the easiest to remove compound. For a 20 square meter room, that's 200 plants. And that's the best case. For less efficient plants and harder compounds, you're looking at a botanical garden in your bedroom.
The snake plant on my windowsill is doing approximately nothing for my air quality.
Chemically speaking, yes. And I want to be precise here, it's not that plants don't remove VOCs. The mechanism is real. Microorganisms in the potting soil do a lot of the work, actually. The roots and soil microbiome break down compounds. But the rate is orders of magnitude too slow to matter in a real building with ventilation.
I want to pause on that soil point, because I think it's worth understanding. You're saying it's not even the plant itself doing most of the work in those sealed chambers, it's the microbes in the dirt.
And this is one of those details that gets completely lost when the finding trickles down to lifestyle blogs. The root zone microbiome is a complex community of bacteria and fungi that metabolize organic compounds. In a sealed chamber with no air exchange, those microbes have time to break things down. But in a ventilated room, the VOCs are flushed out and replaced faster than the microbes can process them. It's like asking someone to mop a floor while someone else is spraying a hose through an open window.
That's a vivid image. So the soil microbiome is doing real work, but it's working on a geological timescale relative to the problem.
But nobody's posting that on Instagram.
10 trays of dirt that will purify your home. Not as marketable.
The aesthetic is lacking.
Yet the NASA study lives on. Every lifestyle blog, every plant shop, every wellness influencer, these 5 plants will purify your air.
It's one of the most durable scientific misconceptions I've ever seen. The study was for sealed spacecraft. It was never meant to apply to homes. Wolverton himself has clarified this in interviews. But the idea that plants are nature's air purifiers is so intuitively appealing that nobody wants to hear the correction.
The intuition is powerful. Plants are good. Pollution is bad. Plants must fix pollution. It feels true.
I should add, there are real air quality interventions for homes. HEPA filters work. Activated carbon filters work for VOCs. If you're worried about indoor air quality, get a proper air purifier with both HEPA and carbon stages. Don't buy a fern and call it done.
Here's where I want to complicate things before we completely bury the indoor plant. Daniel mentioned something in his prompt that I think is actually the more interesting angle. He said plants make us feel better somehow, and he doesn't understand it but knows it's true. And he's right. There's something there that isn't about chemistry.
This is where the evidence is actually much stronger. The psychological and physiological effects of indoor plants are well documented. There's a whole field of research on this, sometimes called horticultural therapy, sometimes just environmental psychology. A systematic review from 2015 looked at the effects of indoor plants on occupants and found consistent benefits. Reduced stress, lower blood pressure, improved mood, better self-reported well-being.
That's not just, I like looking at pretty things. There's something deeper going on.
There's a hypothesis called biophilia. E. Wilson popularized it in the 80s. The idea is that humans evolved in natural environments, and we have an innate affinity for living systems. When we're around plants, our parasympathetic nervous system activates. It's the rest and digest response. Heart rate drops. Muscle tension eases.
The plant isn't cleaning the air, but it is changing the human in the room. And the human breathes differently, feels differently, thinks differently.
Here's a concrete finding. There was a study in the Journal of Physiological Anthropology where they had subjects do a computer task, then either look at a plant or look at a blank wall. The plant group had significantly lower diastolic blood pressure and reported less fatigue. It's measurable.
How big was the effect? I'm curious if we're talking about a tiny blip or something clinically meaningful.
The diastolic drop was about 5 to 6 millimeters of mercury on average. That's not enormous, but it's in the range of what you'd see from some mild relaxation interventions, and it was consistent across subjects. The interesting thing is that the effect was strongest not during the task, but during the recovery period after the task. The plant seemed to accelerate physiological recovery from stress.
It's not that the plant prevents you from getting stressed. It's that it helps you come back down faster once the stressor is removed.
That's exactly the pattern. And if you think about how most people experience stress, it's not one continuous event, it's a series of spikes throughout the day. Having something in your environment that speeds up recovery between those spikes could compound into a meaningful difference over time.
The mechanism isn't air chemistry, it's neurochemistry. The plant is a signal to the ancient parts of our brain that says, this is a safe place, this is a place where things grow, you can relax here.
That has knock-on effects for cognitive performance. A study from Norway found that workers in offices with plants reported better concentration and fewer sick days. Now, some of that might be confounding. Offices with plants might be better managed offices in general. But the pattern shows up across enough studies that I'm comfortable saying plants in indoor spaces provide real psychological benefits, even if they don't scrub your benzene.
Daniel's instinct is right. A home without plants would be sad, but not because the air would be unbreathable. Because we are organisms that evolved in green environments, and a sterile box makes our nervous systems unhappy.
I should mention humidity. Indoor plants do increase local humidity through transpiration. In Jerusalem, where Daniel and Hannah live, the air can be very dry, especially in summer. A few well-placed plants can modestly raise the relative humidity in a room. Not enough to solve a serious dryness problem, but noticeable.
I practice leaf medicine, and even I have to admit, that's a marginal benefit.
Your leaf medicine is an entirely different category of dubious.
We're not opening that door today. Let's move to the bigger picture. Daniel wants to know if this is about aesthetics, or if there's a practical reason we need green in urban environments.
It's both, and the practical reasons are more compelling than most people realize. Let me start with the most obvious one that nobody thinks about.
The urban heat island effect.
Cities are typically 1 to 3 degrees Celsius warmer than surrounding rural areas. And on hot nights, the difference can be 10 degrees or more. Concrete, asphalt, brick. These materials absorb solar radiation during the day and re-radiate it at night. They have what's called high thermal mass and low albedo.
Albedo being reflectivity.
Dark surfaces absorb more. A green space, actual soil and vegetation, does two things. First, plants reflect more solar radiation than dark asphalt. Second, and this is the bigger one, they cool through evapotranspiration. Water evaporating from leaves takes heat with it. A single large tree can transpire 400 liters of water on a hot day. That's the cooling equivalent of about 8 room-sized air conditioners running for 20 hours.
A park is literally an air conditioner for the neighborhood.
A passive, zero-energy air conditioner, and the effect extends beyond the park boundaries. There's a well-studied phenomenon called the Park Cool Island effect. The air temperature in a park can be 2 to 8 degrees cooler than the surrounding streets, and that cooler air spills out into adjacent blocks. The effect typically reaches 100 to 300 meters from the park edge.
If you're within a few blocks of a decent-sized park, you're getting a real thermal benefit.
This matters enormously in a warming climate. Heat waves kill more people than any other natural disaster in most developed countries. During the 2003 European heat wave, about 70,000 people died. Urban green space is literally a public health intervention against heat mortality.
Can we put a finer point on that? What's the actual mechanism of heat death, and how does a cooler microclimate interrupt it?
The primary mechanism is that the human body can only shed heat when the external temperature is lower than skin temperature, about 35 degrees Celsius. When ambient air stays above that threshold, especially at night, the body never gets a chance to cool down. Core temperature keeps rising. It's a physiological cascade that becomes irreversible surprisingly quickly. A green space that's 3 or 4 degrees cooler than surrounding streets, especially at night, when the heat island effect is strongest, can be the difference between crossing that threshold and staying below it. During the 1995 Chicago heat wave, which killed over 700 people, researchers later mapped the deaths and found they clustered in neighborhoods with the least tree cover.
This isn't abstract. The tree canopy is a survival factor.
And it's going to become more of one. The IPCC projections for the Eastern Mediterranean show more frequent and more intense heat waves. Jerusalem specifically is looking at more days above 35 degrees. The green infrastructure you plant now is disaster preparedness.
Let's bring it back to Jerusalem for a moment, since that's where Daniel is. You mentioned in a previous discussion that Jerusalem's air quality problem is partly geographic, the dust from the Sahara.
Yes, and this connects to green spaces in an interesting way. The dust is PM2.5 and PM2, fine particulate matter that gets deep into lungs. Vegetation captures particulate matter. Leaves have complex surfaces, hairs, waxes, stomata, and particles deposit on them. A tree canopy can reduce local particulate concentrations by 10 to 25% depending on species, density, and conditions.
I want to make sure we're not overselling this. Trees aren't HEPA filters either.
No, they're not. And the effect varies enormously. Conifers with dense, complex foliage capture more particles than broadleaf trees. Trees near busy roads can reduce street-level PM concentrations by creating a barrier effect, but only if the canopy is dense enough. A row of sparse trees does essentially nothing, and the particles aren't destroyed. Rain washes them to the ground, or they get resuspended by wind.
The tree is buying you time and distance. The particle lands on a leaf instead of in someone's lung. That's a real transfer.
And at urban scale, the cumulative effect matters. A modeling study of London estimated that the city's trees remove about 1260 to 2200 tons of PM10 per year. That's on a baseline of thousands of tons emitted. It's not solving the problem, but it's a measurable reduction.
It's free, passive, self-maintaining infrastructure that also looked beautiful and provides shade and habitat. Hard to argue against that package.
Let me add another dimension that gets overlooked. Green spaces manage water. Cities are mostly impermeable surfaces, roads, roofs, parking lots. When it rains, water runs off, picks up pollutants, and overloads drainage systems. This is how you get flash flooding and combined sewer overflows. Vegetated soil absorbs water. A mature tree can intercept hundreds of liters of rainfall on its leaves and branches, slowing the rate at which water hits the ground. Root systems create channels for infiltration. Urban green spaces reduce runoff volume and peak flow rates.
In a place like Jerusalem, where rain comes in intense bursts during a short winter season, that's not trivial.
Not trivial at all. And this is where green belts specifically come in. The concept goes back to Ebenezer Howard and the Garden City movement in the late 1800s. The idea was to surround cities with permanent rings of countryside, agricultural land, forests, parks, that would limit sprawl and provide recreation. London's Greenbelt was established in 1938. It's about 500,000 hectares.
Critics say greenbelts just force development to leapfrog outward, creating longer commutes and more emissions.
That's a real debate. The greenbelt constrains supply inside it, which drives up housing costs, and people end up commuting from beyond the belt. But the alternative, continuous suburban sprawl, has its own costs. Paved over watersheds, lost farmland, car dependency. I think the stronger argument for green belts now is less about containment and more about ecosystem services. Flood protection, heat mitigation, biodiversity corridors, carbon sequestration.
Carbon sequestration is another one where I think people overestimate what urban plants can do. A tree in a park is not offsetting your car.
You're right. A typical urban tree sequesters maybe 20 to 50 kilograms of CO2 per year. A car emits about 4.6 metric tons per year, so you'd need 90 to 230 urban trees per car to offset it. That math doesn't work. Carbon sequestration by urban vegetation is a rounding error in a city's carbon budget.
Don't justify urban trees with carbon math. Justify them with heat, water, particulate capture, and the fact that humans need them to stay sane.
I'd add noise. Daniel mentioned noise pollution. Vegetation attenuates sound. A dense hedge or tree belt can reduce road noise by 3 to 8 decibels. That's modest, but perceptible. And even if the physical reduction is small, the psychological effect of seeing green while hearing traffic seems to reduce annoyance. Multiple studies have found that people report less noise disturbance in greener environments, even when measured sound levels are identical.
That's a fascinating confound. The noise is the same, but your brain processes it differently because the visual context signals. This is less threatening.
The visual presence of nature modulates how we perceive other stressors.
I'm trying to think of an analogy for that. It's almost like if you hear footsteps behind you in a well-lit park versus a dark alley. Same sound, completely different physiological response. The context tells your threat detection system whether to relax or go on alert.
That's exactly the right framing. And it suggests that even the visual component of green space, not the air, not the shade, not the sound attenuation, just the sight of vegetation, has a measurable effect on human stress. Which means a green wall or a carefully placed tree visible from a window isn't just decoration. It's a low-grade, continuous stress reduction intervention.
Which loops back perfectly to the indoor plant discussion. The snake plant isn't cleaning your air, but if you can see it from your desk, it might be lowering your blood pressure while you answer emails. That's not nothing.
It's really not nothing. And I think we underrate cumulative low-grade interventions. A single plant might drop your diastolic pressure by a couple of points for a few minutes. But if you have plants in your home and your office, and you walk through a park on your commute, these things stack. Over years, the accumulated stress reduction could be meaningful for cardiovascular health.
Let me pull on a thread Daniel raised. He said the baseline air quality in Israel is surprisingly bad, almost in India territory, and that a big part is Saharan dust. Is that right?
The comparison to India is probably too strong, but the direction is correct. Israel has significant PM2.5 challenges, especially in spring and autumn when dust storms from the Sahara and the Arabian Peninsula move through. On dust storm days, PM10 concentrations can exceed 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter. The WHO guideline for 24-hour average is 50. Even on non-dust days, the regional background level is elevated because of the semi-arid climate. Dry soil, sparse vegetation, wind, you get resuspension.
That's before you add local emissions from vehicles, industry, and power plants.
Israel's air quality has improved in some respects. The switch from coal to natural gas for electricity generation was a big step, but PM remains a serious public health issue. And here's where urban vegetation plays a specific role in dust corridor cities. Trees and shrubs reduce wind speed at ground level, which reduces dust resuspension. Ground cover, grass, low shrubs, anything that holds soil in place, prevents particles from becoming airborne in the first place.
In a dusty city, green spaces aren't just nice. They're dust control infrastructure.
They work best when they're designed for that purpose. You want multi-layered vegetation, canopy trees, understory shrubs, ground cover. Each layer captures particles at different heights. You want species with rough or hairy leaf surfaces that trap particles effectively. You want irrigation to keep soil moist and prevent it from becoming a dust source. A bare dirt lot with a few eucalyptus trees is not a green space. It's a dust factory with decorative poles.
That last image is going to stick with me. A dust factory with decorative poles. I've seen those lots. They're everywhere in dry cities. People think there are trees. It's a green space, but the ground is bare, compacted dirt, and every gust of wind lifts a cloud.
This is where the design piece becomes critical. If you plant trees but don't establish ground cover, you've created shade which prevents understory plants from establishing naturally, and you've got a permanent dust source underneath a canopy that looks green from a distance. It's worse than useless. It's actively misleading. Policymakers can point to it and say, look, we've greened that area, while residents are breathing particulates from the bare soil.
This is where Hannah's architecture expertise probably intersects. Good landscape design is engineering. It's not just put some plants there.
The difference between well-designed green infrastructure and token landscaping is enormous. A study from Beijing, which has severe PM problems, found that a well-designed urban forest park reduced PM2.5 concentrations by 20-30% inside the park compared to surrounding streets. But the effect depended on canopy density, species selection, and spatial arrangement. Random trees and planters did almost nothing.
Daniel, when you're at the environmental forum, the argument to make isn't trees are nice. It's green infrastructure properly designed provides measurable reductions in heat stress, particulate exposure, and flood risk, with co-benefits for mental health and biodiversity. That's a policy argument with teeth.
It's an equity argument, too. The neighborhoods with the least green space are almost always the lower-income neighborhoods. In cities across the world, tree canopy cover correlates with income. Richer areas are greener and therefore cooler, quieter, and psychologically more restorative. Investing in green space in underserved neighborhoods is environmental justice.
If we connect that back to the heat mortality point, the people dying in heat waves are disproportionately elderly, low income, and living in the least green neighborhoods. It's not a separate issue. The tree canopy map and the heat vulnerability map are basically the same map.
They really are. There was a study from Phoenix, a city that knows something about heat, that overlaid tree canopy data with heat-related emergency calls. The correlation was stark. The neighborhoods with less than 5% tree canopy had call rates several times higher than neighborhoods with over 15% canopy. Same city, same heat wave, radically different outcomes based on vegetation.
I want to circle back to something Daniel said that I think is worth sitting with. He said he thinks we need as much green in cities as possible, and he wants the rationale so he can advocate more effectively. I think the rationale exists, and it's strong. But I also think there's a danger in over-rationalizing.
What do you mean?
I mean that the impulse to make everything utilitarian, to justify every tree with a spreadsheet of ecosystem services, can miss something important. Daniel also said plants make us feel better, and he doesn't understand why, but it's definitely true. That's not a secondary benefit. That might be the primary benefit, and all the particulate capture and cooling is the bonus.
I think you're right. The measurable services are real, and they matter for policy. But if we reduce green spaces to their utility functions, we're missing the deeper point. Humans have lived in and with vegetation for our entire evolutionary history. The last 100 years of urbanization is a blink. Our brains haven't caught up. We're still expecting to see green things, hear leaves rustle, smell soil. When we don't, something is missing.
There's a reason every major religion's paradise imagery involves gardens. There's a reason hospital patients with window views of trees recover faster than those looking at brick walls. There's a reason people pay more for apartments facing parks. We know this stuff intuitively. The science just confirms what we already felt.
The Roger Ulrich study from 1984, gallbladder surgery patients, same hospital, same procedure. One group had windows looking at trees, the other looked at a brick wall. The tree view patients had shorter hospital stays, needed less pain medication, and had fewer negative comments in nurses' notes. That's not about air quality, that's about something deeper.
I want to dwell on that study for a moment, because it's almost too neat. Same hospital, same procedure, same surgeons, presumably. The only variable was what you saw when you turned your head. And it changed recovery outcomes.
Ulrich controlled for as much as he could. Same ward, same nursing staff, same post-operative protocols. The window view was the variable. The tree view patients stayed an average of 7-9 days versus 8.7 for the brick wall group. That's nearly a full day shorter. The pain medication difference was even more striking. The brick wall group required significantly more potent analgesics.
If you're a hospital administrator looking at that data, you're thinking about bed turnover and pharmaceutical costs. But if you're a human being looking at that data, you're thinking about something much stranger. A window is just glass. The trees aren't doing anything to you chemically, but your body heals faster when it can see them.
This is where the biophilia hypothesis gets really interesting. Wilson's argument wasn't just that we like nature. It was that our cognitive and sensory systems evolved in natural environments, and they literally function better when we're in the conditions they evolve for. Remove those conditions, and you get a kind of low-grade systems degradation. Not a failure, just everything running slightly worse.
The tree outside the hospital window isn't a luxury. It's more like the human operating system has an expected environmental input, and when that input is absent, recovery processes run slower. The tree is part of the spec.
It reframes the whole conversation about urban green space. We're not talking about amenities. We're talking about providing the environmental conditions that human physiology expects. The fact that those conditions also happen to moderate temperature and capture particulates is almost a happy coincidence.
Where does this leave us for Daniel's questions? Let me try to synthesize. Indoor plants. They're not air purifiers in any practical sense. The NASA study was for sealed chambers and doesn't translate to real homes. If you have indoor air quality problems, get a proper filter. But indoor plants do improve psychological well-being, reduce stress markers, and modestly increase humidity. They make spaces feel alive. That's a real benefit, just not a chemical one.
For cities, green spaces and green belts provide measurable cooling through shade and evapotranspiration, reduce local particulate concentrations by 10 to 25% under good design, attenuate noise, manage stormwater runoff, and provide habitat. But equally important, they meet a human psychological need that we're only beginning to quantify. They reduce stress, improve cognitive function, and make urban life feel less hostile.
The policy argument for green space doesn't need to choose between the utilitarian and the aesthetic. It's both. The cooling and the particulate capture are real and measurable. The psychological benefits are real and measurable. They reinforce each other.
I'll add one more thing for Daniel's forum work. The cost-benefit analysis for urban green space is extraordinarily favorable when you include health outcomes. Reduced heat-related mortality, reduced cardiovascular and respiratory hospitalizations from lower PM exposure, reduced mental health treatment costs. A study from Toronto estimated that the city's urban forest provides about $80 million per year in ecosystem services, with the largest share coming from air quality and energy savings from shading. And that's before you count the harder-to-monetize benefits.
Those harder-to-monetize benefits are probably the biggest ones. How do you put a dollar value on a child growing up able to see trees? How do you value a neighborhood where people actually want to walk outside in August because the street is shaded?
You can't really, but you can point to property values, which consistently show premiums for proximity to green space. You can point to retail studies showing that shoppers spend more time and money on tree-lined commercial streets. You can point to crime data. There's some evidence that greener public housing projects have lower rates of violent crime, though the causality is messy. The economic signals all point in the same direction, even if you can't capture everything in a single number.
There's also a temporal argument. A tree planted today might take 10 or 20 years to reach maturity and deliver its full benefits. But the urban heat island is getting worse, not better. Climate models project more frequent and intense heat waves across the Middle East. Planting now is an investment in resilience that pays out over decades.
The tree doesn't depreciate. It gets more valuable every year. Bigger canopy, more shade, more evapotranspiration, more particulate capture. A mature urban tree is one of the few pieces of infrastructure that improves with age.
Unlike certain podcast hosts.
I'm going to let that pass because I'm feeling generous.
I do want to add one practical note for Daniel, since he's going into these environmental forums. When you're making the case, lead with the numbers, the temperature reductions, the particulate capture percentages, the flood mitigation data. That's what gets the attention of budget offices and planning departments. But don't leave out the human stuff. The hospital window study, the blood pressure data, the fact that people in greener neighborhoods report less stress. The hard-nosed and the humanistic arguments aren't competing. They're the same argument wearing different clothes.
If you get pushback on cost, the Toronto number is a good reference point. Urban forests return multiple dollars in services for every dollar spent on planting and maintenance. It's not a cost. It's an investment with a measurable return.
Daniel, Jason, Hannah, if you're listening, The plants in your home aren't scrubbing your formaldehyde, but they are doing something real, and the green spaces in your city are doing a lot more than most people realize. The case for them is stronger than it looks nice, and you don't have to choose between the hard-nosed engineering argument and the humanistic one. They're the same argument, seen from different angles.
Jason, keep bringing the sorbet. Keep taking the saplings. The world needs more people who care about plants, even if they can't explain exactly why.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. It has been since the 1300s, when it first appeared on the Scottish Royal Coat of Arms.
That explains a lot about Scotland.
It really does.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running. You can find us at My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.